You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 12th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, one of the greatest bank frauds in history. A wealthy Vietnamese property developer is convicted of channeling billions into her company, and she's sentenced to death for her crimes. Also ahead, Belarus President Lukashenko is in Moscow. We'll look at his relationship with President Putin and examine any cracks. We'll be in Geneva to hear more from the Watches and Wonders show and hear more from the man in charge of restoring one of Antoni Gaudí's most beloved buildings, the Casa Batlló in Barcelona.
Antonio Gaudí's homes, maybe this one is the most singular ones for us, of course, because it's really wonderful with a lot of colors, with a lot of elements.
Andrew Muller will fill us in on highlights from the last 7 days.
If you thought there was any subject into which a certain section of US broadcast media could not shoehorn their morbid obsession with the Mexican border, you were wrong.
Plus the papers too. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in today's news. The USA has ordered its employees in Israel not to travel out of certain parts of the country amid fears of an attack by Iran. A large power plant near to Kyiv has been destroyed by a Russian missile strike. And Britain's Royal Mail says it's working to remove counterfeit stamps from circulation after claims they're originating in China. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio for more on these stories throughout the day. But first, a court in Vietnam has sentenced to death a wealthy property developer for defrauding a bank of billions of dollars. Trong Mae Lan was found guilty of embezzlement, bribing state officials and violating regulations. She used her hidden ownership of a bank to obtain billions of dollars of loans for her own company. Well, I'm joined now by Bill Hayton, Associate Fellow at Chatham House's Asia Pacific programme and author of A Brief History of Vietnam. A very good morning to you, Bill.
Good morning, Emma.
So just tell us a little bit more about Trong Mae Lan.
So she started off very humbly selling cosmetics on a market stall and then rapidly rose through making connections and deals and, you know, became, you know, one of the richest women in certainly in Vietnam, you know, probably in the world, I guess. In some ways, it's a very typical story of how you make it in Vietnam, you know, through connections. But also, you know, completely atypical in the size of the amounts of money that were embezzled. She basically, although her name wasn't on the papers, she basically owns 91% of this bank through contacts and shell companies and things like that. And according to press reports, 93% of this bank's lending went to her companies. So she was basically just using it as her personal piggy bank, and she was in cahoots with the guy who was the Communist Party secretary in Ho Chi Minh City for many years. He was taken down a few years ago, and that basically sort of opened the door, I think, for the prosecutors to go after her.
Tell us a little bit more about, you know, the scale of the fraud here. I mean, I think I read somewhere that the amount of money embezzled, which is more than $12 billion, is the equivalent to almost 3% of Vietnamese GDP.
Yeah, and I think she has been told that all her companies have been told to pay back a total of, I think, $27 billion in equivalent. So, I mean, it's just, you know, eye-watering amounts of money. And it's basically because the bank was lending to her companies to go off and do projects. And, you know, some of these were, you know, I guess you might say legitimate real estate projects. Some of them were, you know, for her, you know, personal estate. And it wasn't just Vietnamese. Her husband was from Hong Kong and involves companies in Hong Kong and in Singapore. And I guess, you know, one of the sort of parts of this story is that she herself is from the Vietnamese Chinese minority, and she has many connections that sort of go around the region to the diaspora Vietnamese community and other Chinese communities around Southeast Asia. And that will help to kind of bring in yet more money into this empire.
Indeed. I mean, tell us a little bit more about the international effect of this, because internationally, Vietnam has become or is becoming a rather important manufacturing player. Its economy is growing fast. Yet to have someone able to commit a crime at this scale, I mean, what does it do for Vietnam's international reputation?
Well, you're right that Vietnam is increasingly important as a manufacturing hub. Let's say, I mean, that Samsung, the South Korean mobile phone maker, I mean, provides something like a fifth of all Vietnam's manufacturing exports. It's a huge hub for Samsung. It's no way near replacing China, say, in scale, Vietnam, but a lot of companies are looking at Vietnam as they try to hedge against risks in China at the moment. But I think that, you know, what this tells us is that there are ways of doing business in Vietnam which are, you know, not, you know, by the book, if you like. And, you know, the corruption is the way the system works in Vietnam. It's how, you know, loyalty is maintained, that spoils are shared out and all the rest of it. So the idea of sort of eradicating corruption, I think, is just a non-starter in Vietnam. And, you know, it is to some extent a kind of, you know, still a frontier market with lots of people, you know, kind of who have made their way up through the system in a time of, you know, very loose and, you know, sort of basic regulation, who are still at the top and whose main priority is about getting things done rather than, you know, following the letter of the law.
You mentioned there the idea of wiping out corruption in Vietnam is a non-starter, but it's been, what, a decade since the Communist Party there tried to launch an anti-corruption campaign. How big a scalp is Trong May Land's in terms of disincentivizing those who want to act in a corrupt manner? Or indeed, is this just the beginning of picking out further characters like this?
Well, there's two parts of the Vietnamese anti-corruption campaign. It's launched by the guy at the top of the Communist Party as a way of trying to cleanse the party itself of a dangerous class, as it's called, of corrupt individuals who were seen as undermining the party's credibility and actually the sort of the political integrity of the party. So that's part of it. But it's also... it's also a factional battle. He's trying to get rid of his opponents, but it's also, you know, there were all these really egregious cases of corruption and embezzlement going on, which cause people to be very, very unhappy. There's many facets to this, but you know, the whole way that the sort of party can sort of, you know, maintain the support of, you know, wealthy business people and, you know, its own members, you know, in the system is by flows of money and sort of making sure that patronage is sort of shared out among, you know, a large enough group of people. So take that away, then what kind of binds people together? So I think it's an almost impossible task to get rid of corruption.
Well, I mean, we're looking at, what, 85 other people who've been charged in Trong May Land's case. I mean, who are they and where do they stay? Where do they sit in this whole system?
Well, they're a mixture. I mean, some of them are family members, but importantly and crucially in this case, one of them was a banking regulator at the State Bank of Vietnam who reportedly received over $5 million in bribes, to look the other way. And, you know, when you have sort of that amount of money floating around in the system, you know, and bearing in mind that nominal state salaries are still in the sort of hundreds, you know, maybe thousands of dollars a month, just a little bit. And if some, you know, if a banking boss can come up and offer you, you know, $5 million, you know, to not audit the bank's books as thoroughly as you might, you know, it's very hard to resist that if you're a sort of low paid state official. So, yeah, I mean, Vietnamese often talk about having, you know, one leg in the system and one leg out of the system. You know, you have some, you know, your connections in the system who kind of help you, and, you know, you operate, you know, in the private sector outside the political system. But you require your connections on both sides in order to function.
Tell us a little bit more about what happens next. I mean, given the fact that she has been sentenced to death, and that is perhaps what is, you know, not just in terms of the scale of her embezzlement, but also the shocking consequences. How likely is that to happen?
I think very unlikely myself. I mean, the death penalty itself is a state secret in Vietnam, so it's very hard to find out exactly how many people are executed in any one year. And Vietnam has the death penalty for quite a lot of crimes, including things like drug trafficking, for example. But I would be very surprised if someone is executed for embezzlement. Usually the death penalty is imposed, and there have been other high-profile corruption cases in the recent past, as a means of leverage, you have to, tell us everybody else who was involved. You have to give us back all of the assets that you stole, or else. And then that's, by imposing the death penalty, that focuses the mind somewhat. The pressure is then on her to name names, and maybe that'll become part of the political struggle in Vietnam over who takes over the Communist Party next, who was involved in her scandal. And it also might be about giving back assets that she may have hidden away in different parts of the country, or even overseas.
And you mentioned other high-profile corruption cases in the past. How many more Chuang Mei Lans are lurking, ready to be prosecuted and brought to trial?
That's a very, very good question. They tend to sort of start small, these little corruption cases, and they sort of pull the thread and gradually and they work their way up the system. Usually what has to happen is you have to sort of not just be corrupt, but be ostentatiously corrupt. And you have to be involved with maybe politicians who the guys, and they're almost all guys at the top, want to take down. Vietnam has a very decentralized political system, and so you get these different fiefs in different cities and provinces who can kind of run the show in their own part of the country. When the center in Hanoi decides things are getting out of hand, it sends in the inspectors and the police and the anti-corruption commission and the discipline inspection commission, to kind of really go through everybody's, waste paper bins and take people down. So really you have to fall out of political favor with Hanoi, and then they send the teams in. So if you kind of play along with the demands of the party leadership, you keep delivering economic growth, you're kind of seen to do the right thing, you probably get away with it. But then something maybe can tip the balance and you can fall out of favor.
Bill Hayton, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. a.m. in Moscow, 7:13 a.m. here in London. Now, the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, is in Moscow for a two-day trip, meeting President Putin for talks. President Lukashenko has had a reputation for being a steadfast supporter of Vladimir Putin, but lately there have been pinch points, first in the summer of last year, after the Wagner chief Yevgeny Prigozhin attempted a mutiny against Putin. It was a Belarusian leader who helped to broker a deal to allow Prigozhin and some of his fighters to go to Belarus. Then last month, in the aftermath of the terror attack on the Crocus Music Hall in Moscow, Lukashenko contradicted claims by Vladimir Putin that the attackers were initially heading to Ukraine. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined now by Franek Viakorka, who's a journalist from Belarus and the chief political advisor to the leader of the Belarusian Democratic Movement, Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya. A very good morning to you, Franek.
Good morning.
So just tell us a little bit about the official purpose of Lukashenko's visit to see Vladimir Putin.
First of all, let me correct you. In the beginning, you called Lukashenko the president, but no democratic countries to recognize him as president. He became a criminal who seized the power in Belarus and Putin's puppet. And all these visits that are taking place in the last few years, they remind me the seances of psychotherapy. Because these two dictators, they need each other, and they are trying to show to their population that everything is under control, the war is going well, they are trying to evade sanctions. And this visit, yesterday's talks and today's talks, it's just another attempt to show that two dictators are winning, the West is losing. Of course, they will be talking about evading sanctions again. They will be talking about Western threat to Belarus, Russian Union state. But I don't think, that these meetings, they mean a lot. It's a 19th meeting in the last year and a half. 19, and it's a 150th meeting in last 20 years. So I think, you know, there are no more than PR from this meeting.
Tell me a little bit more, Franek, as to whether Lukashenko still is Putin's puppet. I mean, I mentioned a moment ago that cracks emerged last year when Yevgeny Prigozhin marched on Moscow. And it was Lukashenko who stepped in and warned everybody to calm things down. And then Wagner, the group, ended up going to Belarus.
Oh, yeah, this thing with Prigozhin, it reminds the Netflix show, you know, because there was a mutiny. Everyone felt like Putin is getting to an end and Prigozhin will come to Moscow. And suddenly Lukashenko appears. And it seems that Lukashenko was asked by Putin to become a mediator between Prigozhin and Putin. And then he invited Prigozhin to Minsk. He gave him the safety security guarantees, which meant nothing in the end because Prigozhin was killed on the plane. Lukashenko was trying, of course, to adapt the Wagner group and to use Wagner mercenaries for his own defense. But very soon, all these Wagner mercenaries, they left, most of them, they left Belarus because they work for money and Lukashenko didn't have this money to pay them. So I could say that, you know, this story with Wagner and Prigozhin in Belarus is over. Only a few dozens of them still in the country, mostly working as trainers, as instructors. But Wagner's organization does not exist in Belarus anymore.
Tell us a little bit more about the aftermath as well as the attacks on the Crocus Hall in Moscow, because Vladimir Putin in the immediate aftermath said that Ukrainian nationals have been preparing a route of escape for the terrorist attackers. But then Lukashenko comes on and says, the orchestrators, we have our suspicions about some of them, and I intend to call Putin to convey my suspicions. He gave the impression that he was contradicting Vladimir Putin publicly.
Oh, I think they're playing in the same orchestra, but they are playing different instruments. You know, sometimes their messages are controversial because they send them to different audiences. For Putin, it's important to justify against Ukrainians. And for Lukashenko, it's important to show that enemies everywhere and to consolidate security apparatus, to show that, oh, terrorists are coming. This is why you have to unite around me. So they're working just for different target groups.
And tell us a little bit more about, you know, you discuss the fact that these meetings are happening regularly. But what does that suggest about the role that Belarus is playing with Russia in the war against Ukraine? What is the latest there?
So no shelling, no missiles launched from Belarus territory anymore. Belarus army did not participate. In Belarus society, there is strong anti-war consensus. Last survey I saw last month, only 3% of Belarusians support participation of Belarus army. But Lukashenko gains money on the war. 12 enterprises right now produce stuff for Russian military, for Russian tanks, armored vehicles. So Belarus became the military assembly shop for Russian army. And for Putin, it's very important to have control over Belarus as the buffer zone between NATO countries and Russia.
Just how much does Vladimir Putin need Belarus under Lukashenko to keep his war machine going and to keep his international strength going?
Yes, absolutely. They need each other, basically. Lukashenko needs Putin to have control over Belarus and have military support of Putin. And Putin needs Lukashenko because he is cheap. You know, he's like Vichy's regime in France during Second World War. You know, when formally it's independent and sovereign country and government, but de facto serving the interest of metropole, which is Moscow in our case. So let's not see Lukashenko as independent player. He implements all the orders that are coming from Moscow.
And as a result, how long do you think Lukashenko will stay in power, given what you suggest is that he will stay as long as Putin wants him there?
Putin will support Lukashenko till the very last moment. But Lukashenko is much less stable than Putin. Putin has support in Russia. Russians support the war, many of them, of course. But in Belarus, Lukashenko is more fragile. So I think, you know, when changes will start, when the new window of opportunity will open, we will see big things happening in Belarus, and we must be prepared for these changes.
And finally, when it comes to mounting an opposition to all this, I mean, we saw in Russia what happened to Alexei Navalny. His posthumous memoir is coming out in October, which will serve as almost a template to many in terms of how to mount a resistance against a regime. What effect does the story of Navalny and the death of Navalny have on your attempts to try to secure independence and freedom in Belarus?
It is shocking. It is shocking to all of us because we have thousands of people held hostages in Lukashenko's and KGB prisons in Belarus. We don't know fates of many. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, our leader, she didn't hear about her husband anything for more than 1 year. She doesn't know if he is alive at all. 2 days ago, another political prisoner died. Every month, someone dies in Lukashenko's prisons. And we need a strong international reaction. I think it's a task for the United Nations to stop the death in prisons of Lukashenko and Putin.
Franek Viakoka, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. Still to come on today's programme.
We learned this week that Fox News had decided, just this once, to try approaching science on its own terms.
You know what I like about it too, Jonathan? I feel that it's full circle on the word corona. I can't really find any political agenda in this story, can you?
Hold, as the saying goes, her beer.
We'll hear more from Andrew Muller a little later on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
And you're back with The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. The time is just approaching 7:22 here in London. Let's continue with a look at today's newspapers. And we head to Nairobi to hear from Navina Kotto. A very good morning to you, Navina. How is it looking where you are?
I did say that the rains were coming and the rains have come. So it's a bit of a wet morning here, but usually the sun comes out in about an hour or so. So it's not too bad.
OK, glad to hear it. And glad to hear that we're now turning the Globalist into the Kenyan weather forecast. It's becoming a rather reliable little thing to do. Navina, tell us what's in the papers, if you would.
Yes, I think one of the biggest stories on the continent is that it looks like, according to State TV in the country of Niger in West Africa, that Niger and Russia are going to increase military cooperation. According to State TV, 100 military trainers from Russia arrived this week. I watched the broadcast, and it was very clear that there was a phone call between Vladimir Putin and the leader of the military. They're talking about multisexual cooperation in Niger. We also saw Russian military instructors on TV speaking French, saying they had come to support the government. From what we understand, around 100 military trainers have arrived, as well as an air defense system.
And what do we believe that they will do?
Well, I think it is a pattern that we have seen in other countries in the region. Russia wants to increase military cooperation. It's presenting itself as a country outside Africa that doesn't have a colonial footprint on the continent. It says it can support the Nigerian army that is struggling with security issues in the south of the country. And it has increased similar cooperation in Mali, in Burkina Faso, and probably most successfully in the Central African Republic.
Tell us a little bit about what the wider implications are as a result of what you've just said. The fact that, you know, this is now happening right across various areas, including, it, as you mentioned there, in the Sahel. The fact that Niger is being drawn into this as well, what are the long-term implications?
Yes, I think for Western countries that were relying on Niger as the sort of last standing military cooperation partner in the Sahel, this is a very worrying development. It's something that they have been concerned about for a couple of months. It's important to remember that Europe, the European Union, but also Italy, the UK, the United States had bases there, had increased their military cooperation. The previous Nigerian government also supported sort of anti-migration measures that the Europeans wanted them to take. And I think we will now see increased military cooperation and possibly also increased economic cooperation, because that is what we have seen, for example, in the Central African Republic, where Russian groups have been very active in exploiting the minerals that are available in the Central African Republic in return for military protection to a central government.
Let's move on to a story that's being reported by RFI in France, but it's to do with Mali, and it's to do with the authorities in Mali have effectively suspended every party political group, haven't they? And you know, it's a military junta which is now imposing its weight.
Yes, the junta has been in place since August 2020. This junta is also supported by Russia. They were supposed to hold elections on March 26th. These were then delayed indefinitely, they say, for technical reasons. And at the end of March, 80 political parties and associations had called for a return to the constitutional order in Mali. They had also called to hold presidential elections as soon as possible. And this announcement to suspend all political activity seems to be a response to this basically call. The military junta said that basically all political parties are now banned from activities, public activities, and it also imposed a ban on media coverage of political life yesterday. So I think it looks like the government is cracking down. It is. So far, it hasn't been able to really perform for the public. The security situation in Mali has actually worsened in the last couple of years. So I think we will have to wait and see how if they are prepared to crack down even more.
What has caused them to do this right now? Because as you say, the junta has been in power since, for a good part of 4 years now.
Yes. I mean, the military leader has been announcing that he's going to hold elections every year. These elections were always delayed. But it has also meant that due to the lack of a constitutional order, aid from outside has been cut. Mali is increasingly relying on Russia. And I think the fact that the country has not been able to deliver economically for the public, nor military, nor been able to get the military situation under control. Mali also has security problems in the north of the country. I think it has meant that there has been more pressure from civil society organizations on the military government to step down and introduce a constitutional order again. And this is a pushback against this.
Now let's move to where you are, to Kenya, and the conference of Catholic bishops who have pronounced on the state of the country's economy.
Yes, I think it's something we keep on talking about here. The country is, or the budget is under a lot of pressure because the country has to repay foreign debt. In order to secure IMF loans, the president has introduced higher taxes on fuel, but also on other goods, on income. He has increased income tax. And this goes hand in hand with increased inflation over the last 2 to 3 years. So, I mean, I think we've talked about it a fair number of times that the ordinary public is really struggling financially, but now the Kenyan Conference of Catholic Bishops has indeed stepped in. They made a public statement saying that asking basically President Ruto to stagger the new taxes he's planning to introduce to avoid overburdening the public. And they also said that the high level of taxation in the country has led to increased mental distress among the citizens. I think it's quite interesting. It is something that we've all been observing, but I think it's interesting that the Catholic Church has decided to step into this.
Finally, let's go to South Africa and look at what you might see would be a fairly innocuous piece of rock. But in fact, on closer inspection, it appears to be a stingray. And when you do even more research, or when others have done more research, it appears to be a 130,000-year-old piece of art.
Yes. So the researchers who undertook this piece of research, they're all based at Nelson Mandela University in South Africa, say it is quite tricky to exactly determine what it is, how old it is, and what it depicts. But they do think indeed that based on sort of analysis they did with light, that this piece of rock is 130,000 years old, and that someone created it to resemble an endemic blue stingray. If this is all true, then it is probably sort of the oldest piece or the oldest example of a human creating an image of another creature. They are saying they are trying to kind of test it even further, but it's I think it's quite interesting to look at.
It is, Navina. Thank you so much indeed for joining us on the programme. You're listening to The Globalist. That was Navina Cutter on the line from Nairobi. The time here in London is 7:30. A quick look now at the latest headlines. The USA has ordered its employees in Israel not to travel out of certain parts of the country amid fears of an attack by Iran. Embassy staff have been restricted to the Greater Jerusalem, Tel Aviv and Be'er Sheva areas. It follows an attack by Israel on the Iranian consulate in Syria. The UK and Germany have both urged Iran not to escalate the situation. A large power plant near Kyiv has been destroyed by a Russian missile strike. Power facilities across Ukraine were also affected by attacks, raising fresh fears about the country's energy systems. Volodymyr Zelensky, the president, has launched an appeal to Western allies for more aerial support. A fighter jet belonging to the Peruvian Air Force is missing after communication was lost as it carried out low-altitude training. A search and rescue team was dispatched immediately after the Mirage 2000 fighter plane lost contact during the exercise in the south of the country. And Britain's Royal Mail says it's working to remove counterfeit stamps from circulation after claims they were originating in China. There's been a rise in the number of fake stamps being bought from retailers, prompting suggestions they're being sanctioned by the Chinese state. The Chinese embassy in London has dismissed the story as absurd. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. We head to Geneva in a moment to hear about Watches and Wonders, the luxury watch fair. But first, let's enjoy Andrew Muller's take on what we've learned this week.
We learned this week that Fox News had decided, just this once, to try approaching science on its own terms.
You know what I like about it, too, Jonathan? I feel that it's full circle on the word corona.
Right.
Because we were all in the middle of the coronavirus for, you know, over 3 years, and it had such an obvious negative connotation. And now everyone's talking about the corona of the sun,
right?
And it's something extraordinary and something uplifting. And also, I love that people have no... I can't really find any political agenda in this story.
Exactly.
I can't
don't buy it. I'm
maybe
sorry,
just don't buy it.
Hold, as the saying goes, her beer.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
For we learned this week that if you thought there was any subject into which a certain section of US broadcast media could not shoehorn their morbid obsession with the Mexican border, you were wrong.
Rare celestial event collides with a policy failure on the ground. The southern border will be directly in the path of totality today when the moon covers the sun.
We learned that Fox News probably were assuming, and probably not without reason, that a plurality of their viewers might well assume that a total solar eclipse was not, as it is, a recurrent astronomical event which can be predicted to the minute, centuries in advance, but instead a portent of eschaton akin to the birth of a two-headed goat, or whatever. We learned that, among precisely that cohort and who can at least claim to be diligently representing their constituency, was the US Congresswoman and dingbat Marjorie Taylor Greene, at which point we must again thank the voters of the Georgia 14th for their ongoing contribution to the general gaiety, at minimum for making life much easier for the compilers of whimsical news monologues. We learned that Congresswoman Green was concerned that the eclipse was, in fact, some sort of augury. We learned that, as MTG saw it, the eclipse was merely the first horseman of the apocalypse, as she posted thus on that social media platform owned by someone even she may well think is a bit weird, as will now be read by Monocle's End Times desk chief, Laura Kramer.
God is sending America strong signs to tell us to repent. Earthquakes and eclipses and many more things to come. I pray that our country listens.
We learned when we looked it up, as MTG clearly has not, that if her country listened, to people who actually know anything, they would know that we already know that the next total solar eclipse visible from the United States is due on August 23rd, 2044, it's a Tuesday, with the best views available from Montana and the Dakotas circa late afternoon. Opportunist listeners willing to play the long game should think about predicting this to MTG voters maybe a few weeks ahead, and thereby cause the credulous yokels of the Georgia 14th to prostrate themselves in worship.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
Still, we learned that it had been quite the banner week for Americans being confused by things. We learned that the US Department of State was experiencing difficulty telling the difference between this and this. Which is not to say that the US Department of State was struggling to tell dismal Swedish folk music from annoying Swiss yodeling as such, merely to illustrate that we learned that they could not tell Sweden from Switzerland at all. We learned this from a State Department broadcast which featured a cartoon map of Europe, which displayed, wedged in between France, Germany, Austria, Italy, and Liechtenstein, Sweden.
Oh, no.
In fairness, they did spell Liechtenstein correctly, which is more than we have ever managed, although in our defence this is largely because we simply don't care.
Can we annex it?
Anyway, settle down. We learned when we looked into this a bit further that there is an entire subgenre of public relations dedicated to delineating the difference between the two somewhat similarly named nations, as in this video from Visit Sweden, addressed to their near namesakes.
Switzerland gets to promote loud noises, such as yodeling. In return, Sweden gets silence and a lack of yodeling.
And this response from Switzerland's ambassador to the clearly confused USA, which he should try calling the UAE, see how they like it.
Speaking of IKEA, a real example of Swedish engineering, Swedish ingenuity, Swedish simplicity. How would you put all this furniture together, this coffee table, this bed, this couch, without a proper instrument? And the proper instrument, the proper tool, is the Swiss knife. Very reliable and very multifunctional.
Though it is, of course, ridiculous that anybody could ever really get Sweden and Switzerland confused, as they are two extremely different countries, one known for being rich and fond of meatballs, an obsession with utilitarian minimalist design, the almost antiseptic cleanliness of its streets, the reliability of its railways, the arguably somewhat reluctant attitude vis-à-vis modern multiculturalism, the frankly unnecessary quantity of accordion in its indigenous music, and not being massively keen on wars, while the other is, etc. Europe, really all much the same once you get off the ferry. For Monocle Radio, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you, Andrew. If you enjoyed that, then another installment of What We Learned airs at the same time next week, right here on The Globalist on Monocle Radio. .38 in Geneva, which is where we head to next, to hear about Watches and Wonders, the luxury watch fair that's on this week. And to tell us more, I'm joined now from the event by Monocle's Markets Editor for Luxury, Brenda Tui. A very good morning to you, Brenda.
Good morning, Emma.
How's Geneva looking today?
You know, it's just gorgeous. I mean, Geneva on the lake glistening. It's just super wonderful, super chic, all those beautiful hotels. And then the shuttle to Watches and Wonders.
So you, have you been on the shuttle yet? And if so, when you got to the end of the shuttle, what have you seen?
Well, everything is pretty seamless here. You know, once you hop out of the shuttle, you're in the huge Palais Expo, where there is every kind of watch you could imagine. I mean, talk about being overstimulated. All of the heavy hitters are there. Cartier, Rolex, Van Cleef & Arpels, Tudor. It's fantastic.
Indeed,
really.
Indeed. I mean, Watches and Wonders website is saying Geneva could become the international capital of time.
I think that's true. I think it's true. If you like a watch, that's where you need to head. It's actually open to the public from the 13th to the 15th. So I would say, come on down and look at all the watches there. Stunning.
Indeed. So the weekend they open the door to the public, but you've been around. And so just tell us a little bit about, you mentioned all, the fact that the big names are there. What are they talking about and what are they interested in this year?
I mean, I would say that, I mean, obviously they're talking and promoting their own brands, but I would say there is a distinctive kind of turnaround from the super huge chunky watches now are becoming smaller, a little more discreet and streamlined. I think that's the big message that I saw here. They're trying to pack all of their complications into something much, much slimmer and finer and smaller in circumference. So the bezels have jumped from maybe 46 millimeters to, a fine 29.
Which sounds
still.
more sophisticated and a lot more elegant. I mean, that to me sounds like a bit of a breath of fresh air, doesn't it?
I mean, I think for both men and women, yeah, it is refreshing. It's funny how your eye, is pleased by something not bigger, but something smaller. Yeah.
So
I mean,
what's caught your eye?
Well, Chopard had the most exquisite cocktail watches, sort of with a nod to the 1960s. Malachite faces, big diamond bezels, again, though small circumference, either with a green crocodile strap to match the green malachite face, or, a gold latticed, beautifully articulated strap. Just so elegant on the wrist, really, really incredible. I mean, something for the evening, I would say. That was gorgeous. Hublot really surprised me. I mean, they're famous for their Big Bang watches. And then they have introduced this year something, 29 millimeter bezel, something so elegant and yet powerful, in rose gold. Something you could wear proudly all day long and into the evening, male or female. I think it works on both wrists. That was pretty cool. There's something for everyone here. I mean, heavy hitters like Cartier, the kings of the kind of streamlined slender watch, are showing everything. It was like walking into, the archive of watches. They had watches from the 1920s, from the 30s, and then they showed you how they have amended them into something exquisite for the 2000s. So that was pretty special. Their animal watches are, I mean, just the best I've ever seen.
And tell us
Yeah.
a little bit more, if you're changing the shape of a watch and you are altering the way it looks and the way that it feels, you, I would imagine, have to change what you use to make these watches and what the ideas behind them are. Are there any different materials being introduced to this process?
A lot of titanium, which of course is completely the opposite of, a heavy gold watch. And it was very deceptive. It looks like it's going to be heavy. And then titanium is such a light and durable and strong material. And you pop it on your wrist and wow, it's you hardly know you've got anything on your wrist at all. So I mean, that was a certain trend. There was a lot of ceramic, a lot of titanium. And it was kind of marvelous to see. I mean, watch straps in ceramic as well, in wonderful colors too. There was a lot of color. We went to see Nomos yesterday evening, and they had a whole wall showing all of their watches. And really, it was a kaleidoscope of colors, ice cream colors, really fantastic, in the most wonderful combinations. And they've been making watches for 175 years, and boy, do they do it well. And their entry point to buy a watch, was far below, let's say, Hublot, which is much more expensive, tenfold. So there's something for everybody here, really and truly.
Brenda, what are you bringing back for me?
What would I like to bring back for you? I mean, I think I'd bring you back the Chopard diamond and malachite watch, definitely. I'm not sure, Emma. Do you want to go gold in the strap, or would you prefer the green crocodile? I might have a problem getting the green crocodile out of here, of course. I might need some kind of an endangered species certificate. Will we just go gold?
No, I quite fancy a crocodile.
Okay. Well, I'll have to work on that today for you. Yeah, that might take all afternoon.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad you're there. Brenda Tui, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Geneva. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Let's talk transport now. Monocle's transport correspondent is Gabriel Lee, and I'm delighted to say he joins us on the line now from Stockholm. Good morning, Gabriel.
Good morning.
Right. Tell us about this amazing announcement that a low-cost airline in India has become the third most valuable airline company in the world.
That's right. Yeah. It's Indigo, the low-cost airline of India, is really fast growing. In general, India, the aviation situation, commercial aviation, is sort of the most exciting place to watch right now in the world because of how fast it's growing. And Indigo has surpassed now Southwest Airlines, the U.S. airline, in terms of market cap, becoming the third most valuable in the world. And this is an airline that last year placed an order for 500 A320 planes in one order. So you're talking about this sort of stratospheric growth, which makes sense, which when you consider that India has been sort of traditionally underserved, very big population, and is on the rise. So interesting times there.
Indeed. So is this a game of catch-up here being done by Indigo in terms of finally being able to service the consumers that are out there? Or is this also a sign of the ambition that it has?
I think it's both. You have the ambition is based on the fact that they're seeing that they can sort of stimulate demand, bring people onto aircraft that have never flown before. And that is happening alongside a growing economy, obviously, and serving, like I mentioned, this huge population of potential customers, right? Many of whom have not traditionally flown and now can with something like a low-cost airline. At the same time, you have Air India completely, renovating its fleet, changing its direction entirely after being taken over by the Tata Group. They also ordered hundreds of planes last year. So, it's just sort of, it's a good place to be an ambitious airline right now.
It's incredible. Right, let's move to Boeing. I'll tell you a quick story. I was on a Boeing 737-800 yesterday, and my 12-year-old son turned around and said, "Mum, is a bit going to fall off this plane?" That suggests perhaps that the reputational issues that Boeing has are extended even to preteens.
Yeah, it's true. It's really fascinating how that's happened with the latest sort of spate of Boeing issues, especially the door plug that blew out in flight. That really sort of reignited people's fears of the 737 MAX, of course, and also just sort of called into question, Boeing's quality, which is right to call into question. But of course, there's this idea that there's been this kind of significant uptick in incidents around the 737. And the Seattle Times had an interesting article looking at that. Has it really increased, or is it more a matter of this perception, which is understandable, of course. And they found that pretty much, at least looking at the U.S., there hasn't been a significant rise. And many of the safety incidents that have been happening with the 737 have to do with things that are universal. They have nothing to do with Boeing, such as turbulence events. So it is interesting to look at the sort of perception and how people are feeling, which is, like you say, it's very much like that right now. People are avoiding the 737 all over the place. But actually, in reality, it's still a safe plane to fly if we look at the numbers.
Are people now avoiding traveling on a Boeing?
Anecdotally, yes, this is what I hear. I mean, I just sort of speaking to people in general, people want to make sure, but there are certain people who will actively avoid it, right? They'll go out of their way. There are others who are just kind of looking at an alternative. If there's an Airbus that's as easy to take, they'll take that one, right? So there's different levels of this. But there is definitely a change in the sort of feeling around Boeing aircraft among the sort of, you know, the traveling public in general, I would say.
And that does create a big, big problem for Boeing, doesn't it?
It's a huge problem. I mean, they have so many problems right now. And it all kind of comes back to the sort of fundamental culture at the company, which hopefully now it's become such a problem and so much in the news and so much on the minds of everybody, including airlines. You know, airlines were the ones that got together to pretty much force out the current CEO, who's leaving later this year now. Welcome news, from my opinion. But yeah, it's a big problem that they have to really address now.
I mean, how do they go about addressing something which now becomes, you know, the consummate chatter when you board a plane now?
Yeah, it's going to take time. I think, you know, they say, you know, always that the sort of the flying public has a short memory, and that is also true. But this has been such a big an ongoing story, and people have been so conscious of it. And so, you know, people have been more aware of aircraft types than ever before, right? You know, you have on Kayak, when you're searching flights now, you can actually choose to exclude specific aircraft, including the MAX, right? So people are paying attention to this in a way they never did before. So, you know, Boeing has a mixture, I think, of a challenge ahead to change their processes, really fundamentally change how they look at safety, which sort of went astray, went off the rails in the past decades. And also to sort of figure out the public relations side of this, which will be not easy at all.
Now, tell us about Lufthansa. They have been beset by strikes from cabin crew. Does this seem to be drawing to an end?
That's right. Yeah. Well, at least on the cabin crew front, it seems to be. They've come to an agreement with the union on a collective pay agreement, basically, which involves a lump sum to sort of address the problem with inflation and various increases going forward. And it seems that this is something that the flight attendants union are happy with. So that's good news for Lufthansa, because they've been struggling with strikes, not only from cabin crew, but also ground staff. And the ground staff issue is still unresolved, but this will come as welcome news that they're not going to see sort of, you know, rolling strikes and having to cancel thousands of flights going into the summer.
Indeed. I mean, one thing that we saw just a few weeks ago is that a strike across the airports and in Germany did bring the country to pretty much of a standstill, which is not what Germany needs at the minute.
Exactly. It's really true that you know, these groups, these unions do have some power, because if they decide to not show up to work, then the whole thing grinds to a halt in terms of aviation anyway. So, yeah, it's a pretty serious issue, and it's good to see that they're sort of taking proactive steps to try and get past it.
Gabriel Lee, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. Now, Barcelona's Casa Batlló is an essential part of the city's charm. Designed by Antoni Gaudí, the great figure of Barcelona's Modernista architecture, the building is a perfect example of Gaudí's imagination taking flight. Well, it is now to undergo a restoration, repairing an area originally reserved for the Batlló family, who originally commissioned Gaudí to design their home. Well, I'm joined now by Xavier Villanueva, who's the architect and restoration director in charge of the work. A very good morning to you, Xavier.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And delighted to have you on Monocle Radio. Thank you for coming on. Now, just explain the significance of the building. It's a private home, which has become a real national treasure, hasn't it?
Yes, exactly. For us, it's a treasure, of course. It's an UNESCO heritage, like 20 years ago. And really, Antonio Gaudí's homes, maybe this one is the most singular ones for us, of course, because it's really wonderful, with a lot of colors, with a lot of elements, and it's not a big one, it's a small one, you know. He has a lot of works in Barcelona, but really this one is a real treasure, like you say, yeah.
Why is it such a treasure? I mean, you walk down a main street, and there it is, as part of the city's architecture. But it really is quite spectacular. For those who haven't seen it, what does it look like, and what's it like inside?
Inside and outside, because really, Casa Batlló, I don't know if it's better to take a look from outside or inside, because really, it's amazing. It's an amazing one, because, for example, the facade is like will be playing colors in all the facades. A lot of You know, the trenchodies, the little pieces from ceramic or crystal that we have in the facade, and it's like we'll be dancing, you know. And inside of the home, we have a lot of spaces in the different levels, from the roof to the basement, then you can visit and you can enjoy all the architecture. It's full of colors. It's full of amazing examples of new architecture from that time. And for us, really, Antonio Gaudí, in that case, he make an incredible project, really.
And now it is your job to restore it. What does the work involve?
Yeah, you have to think that this familiar house has been restoring the last maybe 25, 30 years. And the most amazing things maybe is that today we are restoring, we are continuing restoring, and every day we discover new things. You have to think that 5 years ago, we make a lot of works for restoring the principal facade and other pieces from this building. But just now we are working, for example, in the rear facade that for us is amazing. We are discovering another kind of view of the colors from Antonio Gaudí, because it's really amazing. Not only colors, structural designs, work with a lot of materials, different materials, and really we are enjoying.
Tell us finally, Xavier, Gaudí's architecture is very much a living project. I mean, the buildings that he designed almost look alive. How does it fit into Barcelona life now? And given the fact that I think the announcement was made not long ago that the Sagrada Familia will be finished in 2026. I mean, did anybody quite believe that announcement?
Well, really, Sagrada Familia, yes, they are working too much. I don't know if we will finish or not in 26. I think that 26 will be the highest tower will be finished, but maybe all the work will be finished in the 30, because really is amazing and a very, very big one. For us, our work, our building is a little one. And you have to think we have five examples in Barcelona from Antonio Gaudí's works. We have the La Pedrera, is very close from our home, but it's bigger than this one. Or Parc Güell, or Palau Güell, that is very close from here too, or La Casa Vicens. Really, I think, and I invite all of you to come to Barcelona to visit all these works, because they are amazing. And of course, to come to Casa Batlló, because you will discover how to play with the colors, how to play with the light, and how it's possible to work with a lot of materials who are in a perfect combination. And Casa Batlló is an example for that.
Xavier Villanueva, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. And that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to the producers, Vincent McAvenny, Laura Kramer and Monica Lillis. Our research was George Ruskin. Our studio manager was Tamsin Howard, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The briefing's live at midday here in London. Vincent McAvenny is your host for that. And The Globalist is back at the same time on Monday. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening and have a great weekend.